It is great to be with you today, and it is wonderful that they chose a spot in the warmth, that's for sure, isn't it? I tell you, for all you folks from the north, you can really appreciate that. All right, I'm just going to jump right in. The title is Reimagining Christian Higher Education, and that's not a daunting title at all. But what I'd like to start with, really kind of three questions. Why do we even need to reimagine it? I think we need to really understand kind of our context, where we are in faith-based higher education and in higher education in general. What keeps us from doing this, and what would it look like to reimagine? So at the very end of this presentation, I'm just going to give you a little bit of my dreaming about what it would look like if we reimagined faith-based higher education. But we're going to jump right in. And I have to tell you, the first part of this is going to make you feel like you want to run from the room, okay? So I just want to tell you, hang on. Toward the end, it gets a little bit more positive, and we can move from there. Okay, why do we need to reimagine? There are really four, I would say there are really six shifting plates. I didn't put technology on here. I'll be doing that one tomorrow, but that's one of the shifting plates. And what happens in America is that these plates begin to shift, and they begin to dramatically transform higher education. But then oftentimes we forget to look at the root cause of what's transforming higher education. We just look at, well, gosh, it costs so much. Well, why does it cost so much, and why is that such an issue? Because it has, quite frankly, always cost so much. So what is happening to us, and how do we think about this? I also want to let you know that at the very end, my last slide has my email address. And so if you would like this presentation, feel free to email me, or Russ, we can send it to your office, and you can email Russ and get it, so you won't have to be too vigorously taking down notes. I'll provide those for you. So we're going to go through pretty quickly these four. Wealth distribution, why that matters to us, declining birth rates, the growing ideological divide, and the pace of learning in society. And these are the four that I think are they're bearing down on us in ways that we don't even really realize. And we all know, we've all heard of the growing inequality in America. We know that the top 10% are getting wealthier, and the bottom middle class is really not moving ahead like we want it to. And so this creates more of a tension than we can imagine, because what used to happen is the middle class was growing at the same rate or in some ways faster. So you can see on this slide the bottom 50% and its movement down in terms of share of the national income, and the top 10% moving up. And it really changes when you look at it based on ethnicity. Black and Hispanic households really have not made much progress. White households, we all know and felt the pain of the 2008, and so you see that dip. But we're beginning to recover, where we don't find in the black and Hispanic households that same growth. And what's really happening that puts the pressure on us is it's actually that everything else is going up, isn't it? GDP is going up. Profits and taxes are going up, average 1% income goes up. But the medium household, the group that we really draw from, the parents and the families that come to our universities, that send their kids to their university, are feeling this in ways that they can't even exactly put their finger on. And certainly we have an issue with children living in poverty. And it's always stunning to me when I think about the wealth and the means in America to look at the number of children, almost 43% that live in poverty or near poverty in America. And those are going to be some children that are going to be coming our way. Our lower socioeconomic students are going to be moving forward. But it is, again, what I'm going to try to show you is that you can look at data, but when you drill down, here's the real story in America. So you see in Asians, 29% of the kids live in low income. White, it's 30. Hispanic, it's 61. Black, 61. So you can see there's a huge disparity on the amount of children and wealth within the children. And there's also a great divide in America. We find that children living in poverty seem to locate most readily in the southern half of the United States. And so that creates an even greater divide. But when you begin to think about, well, you know, poverty, it seems like one of those, like, that's just too big of a problem for me to even think about. If you understand it, though, you understand these are going to be the taxes that are coming into higher education. Inadequate nutrition, fewer learning experiences, low-income kids don't have same access to extracurricular. They don't have the same access to computers. They haven't had the enrichment courses, those types of things. And then they're expected to compete on the same way. Lower quality of schools, dangerous streets, less access to friends and services. So you understand that it's not just that we're getting, there's a bigger divide, it's that it's actually pushing more kids into environments like this, and they will be coming to our universities and are coming to our universities with larger and more difficult learning deficiencies than we've ever seen before. But what we see is, I told you you're going to run, you're going to want to be sitting by the pool when you're through with my presentation, okay? So it will get happier, but But isn't college the great economic equalizer, though? Isn't that why we're sitting in this room right now? Is that we can look at those kids in poverty, we can look at the great divide, and we can say education is a road out. Education can help. Well, let's look at that a little closer. We have made great strides in education in terms of completion rate from high school and moving forward. So even if you're in the low quartile of family income, you're still graduating from high school at a 62% rate. It's a little different for urban and rural, but about that rate. And if you're in the top quartile, you're graduating about 89%. So even from high school, you begin to see the great bifurcation. But it's really when you get to college. And this is the one that colleges really need to step up to the plate and understand. This is what happens when you're in college. If you come in and you're in the first quartile, you only have an 11% chance of graduating from the institution in 6 years. Just 11% chance of graduating. If you are in the top quartile, you have a 58% chance. Now, I think that's still ridiculous that it's 58%, and just a little more than half of our students actually ever graduate from college, all because they do still carry their loans. But the real shame of it is only 11% of our low-income students are actually making it through our colleges in 6 years. And so that begins, we begin to be a significant part of the problem in higher ed. We begin to be part of what is really bifurcating us economically. And so we all know, because you've heard from your friends and you've sent kids to college, right? You've heard the major, I would say, complaint or argument about higher education and its value is the increasing tuition. Right? We felt that. You feel that as board members because you have to pass increasing tuition rates every year. That angst of what are we going to do and how do we fund this enterprise, which is salary dependent if we don't increase. But here is the real thing that people don't understand. That's the increase. But what's really happened is net tuition revenue dollars have not been going up. Right? So this is what we're actually bringing into the colleges and university. What's driving the price up is all the different financial aids that we're giving. The discount rate is what driving the cost, the apparent cost up. Because I have friends that work in other fields, and they're always saying to me, why is it going up so much? I don't hear you getting raises or anything like that, and I hear you complaining about not having enough money to do what you want to do and in your work, and why is it not? And you always have to explain to them two things. One is, because of this. Now, the question then is, why do we have that? Well, part of it is because we are in a financial aid arms race, right? We have two schools going after the same kid, and quite frankly, if the kid gets a $6,000 scholarship from one school and a $4,000 from other, you can talk to them about the value and all those kind of things till you're blue in the face, but they're going to take the $6,000 scholarship. I can guarantee you 90% of the time they're going to do that. So we are in an arms race. The other thing that gets hidden in the numbers but is pretty significant, and that is our federal and state dollars to higher education have been not just even, they have been in decline. So we are actually having to take more of the pressure of financial aid than we've ever had to take before. But yet, I was laughing. I was in Zion National Park last summer, and it was late in the evening, so I got back on the bus to go back to the hotel, and it was just myself and one other guy. And he's talking to the bus driver. And he's talking about, yeah, he's going to send a kid to college, and college is so expensive. It's all those expensive bureaucrats up there making all, you know, fat cats, making all that money. Now, I'm sitting in my chair, and I'm like, just let that go, okay? just keep your mouth closed. Just be quiet. You know, he doesn't know. But, of course, I couldn't. And I had to move up in the van and give him a 5-minute course on how our government has stopped investing in higher education. Because that's what people don't understand, is they just look at the colleges and the universities. We're not bringing any more money. So let's just take, for example, the Pell Grant that goes to our lowest income students. Oops, sorry. So here's the Pell Grant. Everything else is going up, but look at that. It is staying flat. Those are for our lowest income. So this top one will show you the blue is the increase in cost of higher education, and the maroon is the increase in Pell Grants across. So there's a larger and larger family contribution that has to be met by the institution, every single student. And so it becomes very, very onerous for us. So this is what you get. You get a growth in student debt. But the real problem in the growth in student debt is not just the student debt, but it's actually wages, okay? The wages for the middle class are not moving up like they were. If we had wages going up at the same time the debt was, then our students could cover the debt in a reasonable period of time. And quite frankly, higher education is still the best investment that you can make in your future. And so it's worth it. But if you get out and you have a degree in social work, and you have $60,000 worth of debt, and your earning potential is going to be about $35,000 in that first year, that debt becomes onerous, doesn't it? It pushes back home ownership. It pushes back all sorts of things that you might want to accomplish in your life. And so it's not just the debt. That's what I keep saying to my friends. I said, we've always been about debt in higher ed. It's the fact that wages aren't paying off the debt in the same way they were. And the fact of the matter is, what we have going on in higher education right now is we have been improving slightly in graduation rates, but we haven't been improving in employment rates. Well, I shouldn't say that. It looks like we're improving in employment rates, but what we haven't been improving in is our underemployment rates, okay? So what happens is a student graduates with a degree in criminal justice. 75% of them are underemployed. So what that means is, for a lot of people in criminal justice, they go into police work, right? You don't need a bachelor's degree in police work. So for you to have a bachelor's degree in that position, you're actually underemployed. Right? So you can see how many of our degrees are underemployed, and about 43% of students that graduate from the university this year will be underemployed. Now, that doesn't always mean that they will stay there, but it certainly means maybe we need to start thinking about colleges and universities as not at a 4 to 6 year, but really begin more to be interested and care about what happens to them the first 5 years out, because that's where they're going to get into the financial problems that will stay within the whole. So again, 2/3 of the graduates will be underemployed 5 years later. So two-thirds of graduates will still be underemployed. And what you're finding is, once you're underemployed, it's very hard to stop being underemployed, okay? So they've done a lot of new research on the fact that that first job out is critically important to put you on a path. So, you know, I have students that, yeah, I'm just going to work at Starbucks for 6 months, and then I'll figure it out. And I'm like, wow, you just paid $120,000. Seems like you would have figured it out before you graduated, and then you're going to start figuring it out. So I think it's going to become more and more incumbent upon us in higher education to really begin to do more to help students think about it. The one thing we do know about this generation is that it's a little delayed, especially in the men. So we can sit back and we can say, well, they're not really ready to figure it out. Or we can say, let's get them ready. Let's figure out what we need to do and move them forward. Okay? Any questions on that? I'm moving pretty fast. Make your head spin, won't it? Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's an issue for us. Obviously, the cost is an issue. The debt burden is an issue, those types of things. But probably the one that's going to be at our door sooner than we could imagine is the declining birth rates in America. So what we found is that we already have slight declines in in students that are going to college. Okay? So what this chart shows you is kind of a complex, but it shows you that this is fall, spring, all the way down to fall 17. So the big losers in students, thank goodness for us, have been the four-year for-profit. Okay, by far. So anytime you look at an average, you always need to ask them, are for-profits included? Because they bring the whole average down. But when you look at decline in students, here we are, four-year private nonprofit. We are still beginning to see, you know, we had our last positive about 4 years ago, and now we're seeing just kind of this lull that we're in that not many of us are growing. I mean, I can just tell you, I know a lot of people across the country, and pretty much everybody's budget models now are for status quo, right? Nobody is projecting growth in their budgets at four-year institutions anymore, which I think is wise. It's really hard when we've been building our universities on growth, and it's really hard when insurance, salaries, and all the others that go into it are going up. So then it actually means that something has to give, even with just this flat thing. But here's the thing that I keep preaching about, because I want institutions to know you need to get ready for what's ahead of us, okay? Since 08, and it was really actually a little bit before 08, we started to see it in the millennial generation, is that kids stopped having babies. I mean, we stopped. And we didn't stop, but you can see that's a pretty dramatic decline. And this is the rate, the percentage, this is the real number. Pretty dramatic decline in birth. And so what usually happens in an economic downturn is that you will have 4 to 5 years where birth rates will slow down. What has happened this time, though, is they haven't started increasing again. Now, we may still get a millennial bubble at the end of their 30s, but we would have thought by now that that would start an uptick already, and it hasn't started an uptick. I always say this is a double-edged sword. This is bad news and good news for us, okay? The bad news is we will have less kids to draw from, you know, and that is bad news. The good news is where the decline in birth rate has really hit has been in underage birth, 15 to 19. Those are really the kids that have stopped having babies. That's their line there, okay? Now, the women, 35 to 42, have actually upticked, but they just haven't upticked enough. So we are seeing a later birth rate, but not nearly enough that we... So a lot of economists get pretty worried about this particular demographic trend, because if you have a birth rate that's depressed for too long, our Social Security system is built on a formula with a birth rate that is much higher than this birth rate. Okay? So it's gonna create problems for all of us. Colleges and universities are gonna be the first to feel that. So really by 2025. So that seems like a long way away, and I know if I'm sitting in your chair, I'm thinking, I'll be off the Board of Regents by then, and somebody else will have to worry about this problem. But what I keep telling people is, you've got to set up for the future now. You can't wait till 2025. It will be too late, and you will be out of business. 5 to 10 of us will go out of, not you, but 5 to 10 private, and they have seemed to be traditionally faith-based, will go out of business every year for the next 5 years, okay? So even in Portland, Oregon, where I'm working right now, our neighbor down the street, which I would have never thought would have gone out of business, they're 2,000 students strong, closed their doors, shuttered their doors, okay? So it is a reality for us, and I'm not trying just to put the fear of God in anybody, but I'm just trying to say these numbers, the way they are, don't work. Okay, they don't work. And you probably found that if you tried to borrow a lot of money lately or anything like that for your university, because the banks have raised all of our bond ratings because they don't think these numbers work. But again, it is a very different map across the country. So here's forecasted growth in high school graduates. Okay, so if you're in Texas, you're going to do fine, except for the fact that everybody in the country is going to Texas to recruit now, okay? I have a home in Dallas. I was home over Christmas. In fact, I think every university around the country has a billboard or something trying to come to Texas. This is growth of high school students over 7.5%. This is a little deceptive because these numbers are so small. Right, so 7.5% of the 2,000 graduates in South Dakota, that doesn't make a big deal of difference in the growth, okay? So it's really, you know, Texas, a few other states, maybe Washington really contributes. But I've always said, if you're in the Northeast, in the Lakes area, those kind of things, you're going to get the hardest hit by this decrease, okay? And it's not going to be even. This is where there's going to be a lot of pain and suffering from universities as they go forward. But you'll also find that the growth in high school graduates is very different across the country. This is white, non-Hispanics. Look at that. There's hardly any place in America where whites are growing, where there would be more white graduates than there were before. Okay? Now, if you're Hispanic, look at that, 7.5%. It's really the browning of America, and I'm not sure that we're ready for it in our institutions. I'm just not sure that we have really completely. I mean, we've talked about access, and we've talked about diversity, and we've talked about those kind of things, but this is a pretty significant shift right here that we want to talk about. And then, of course, Asian Pacific Islanders are moving right along, too. And so that's an interesting phenomena as well. I would have thought California would be dark blue as well. And then blacks are kind of holding their own. But when you look at those, that's high school graduates. This is how they're forecasting who's going to go to college, which is a little different picture, right? Because what they're forecasting is they're saying is that this is who's graduating, but not all of these kids are going to be going to college. Right? So even when you're up here and you see yellow and some of these, you move over here and it's redder and those types of things. So this is an even more kind of alarming picture for what's happening in the country in terms of high school growth and who we will have to choose from, who we will have to recruit is really, really shrinking. And then the last one I want to show you about this is that this is not going to affect elite national four-year institutions. Okay? If you are Harvard, Yale, MIT, Tulane, Vanderbilt, you are not going to be hit by this. Who it is going to be are us, regional 4 years primarily. That's who's really going to take the brunt of this. We will still have a pretty good growth in our national, our research ones, those kind of things. They're not going to feel the impact like we are, but we are going to feel the impact of this decline. But the flip side, before you run out of the room, being chased by a bull, is that online growth is still moving forward at a pretty good clip. It seems to be for most universities, small universities, it still is the foothold, the chance that we have, the moving this forward. The growth of distance education has been relentless. They have gone up when the economy was expanding and when the economy was shrinking and when overall enrollments were growing. So for some reason, over the last 10 years, online education has been able to manage the economic downturns and upturns and those kind of things probably better than four-year has been able to. So you'll see that private, not-for-profit, the average is this is all classes online, so about 16.5% of students that are in private nonprofit are taking all of their classes. This is a few of their classes. So you can see we are predominantly still a face-to-face enterprise. But if we know that the face-to-face enterprise, this market is going to be dwindling and impacted, it does raise the question for, is it time for us to really begin to rethink? And I know Indiana Wesleyan has done a lot of good work on this. But what we have to even understand at Indiana Wesleyan, which I know they understand, I know Matt gets it, is that the online market is getting more and more crowded. I mean, it's ridiculous how crowded that market is. And if you're not in the game right now, I wouldn't say don't get in it, but I would say you're going to have to be really strategic and you're going to have to build it around partnerships because there's not a general, hey, we just put out, you know, back when Indiana Wesleyan started, there were so few of us that you could put out, we've got online, and people flocked to you because you were the only game in town. Now, I don't know about you folks, but oh my gosh, Southern New Hampshire, Arizona State, Maryville, little Maryville, I mean, those places, I know the president at Maryville, and they got a gift for $2 million to spend on nothing but advertising. So that's why you're beginning to see their TV ads at ESPN, those types of things. And that's the kind of leverage that schools are putting in to make this happen. So it really means, you know, we started with adult education. A lot of faith-based schools were early into adult education, and it kind of became a financial engine that saved many of us. Then some of us really were able to get in early with online, and that financial engine really helped us to grow and move. I think the question for most institutions is, what's third? What's next? And how do we get in? How do we really begin to think about that? Because if we wait and we don't get in first, the market is just relentless right now in terms of college students. okay, so that is... Yeah, please. So what's happened is that these mega universities have really been taken over the market. So we know Southern New Hampshire was early in. They've grown. University of Phoenix has lost a lot of its market share, but it's still the largest, right? And so when we say lose a market share at their top, they were 150,000 students. They were putting out more alumni than all the faith-based universities put together. Now that's slowed down, but it hasn't gone away. Right? Is there still a major player that still gets a infusion of cash every couple of years? You can add to this list Arizona State. Lord, have they started? I mean, Arizona State started online 5 years ago, about midway through their president's term, and they're now at 15,000 and probably at 20,000 by the end of this year. And so they will take over. So what it's saying is that a fifth of the students that enroll online enroll in 10 universities. Okay, so that's how conglomerate it is. And most people don't see that trend stopping. So that's what's going to really be the pressure, is that these big universities. I mean, I was laughing again. I was in Dallas, and Arizona State must have Dallas, must have Texas targeted for a spate because, and forgive me, but I listen to ESPN radio. So I have four brothers, so I have to, you know, it's like part of the DNA. On ESPN, Arizona State was every fourth commercial was ASU. And what they tout is that when you graduate, you will graduate with a full Arizona State University degree, right? There won't be any designation that it's ASU online or those kind of things. So it's pretty appealing to a lot of students that don't want to move to Arizona but want an Arizona State University degree. That answer. So that's really, that's the knot in most of our stomachs that work in this space. And then we know the growing ideological divide is really beginning to take its toll. Many congressional scholars have documented that Republicans and Democrats on Capitol Hill are now further apart from one another than at any point in our modern history. Okay? So the Pew Foundation does a social attitudes poll every few years, and this was the last one that they did, and it's just kind of stunning to see what's happened since 2004. So you just take some of these questions, like government regulation of business usually does more harm than good. Well, in 2004, we were different, but we weren't that different, right? But now look at us. We're really split. Government is always wasteful and inefficient. We almost all completely agreed with that, and now it's that kind of... You can just go down. Government can't afford to do much to help the needy. Look at that gap. And I should say, red is Republican, blue is Democrat. So you see this huge ideological gap. Blacks who can't get ahead in this country are mostly responsible for their own condition. Republicans, 79% agree with that, 50% of Democrats, which to me is actually surprising that 50% of Democrats agreed with that statement. Best way to ensure peace is through military strength. Homosexuality should be discouraged by society. And I know for many of us on our campuses, I work at a Church of God campus, and this has been one of the biggest points of contention because our school is also in Portland, Oregon, extremely liberal university. But as you can see, homosexuality should be discouraged. Both parties have made a pretty strong downward movement on that issue. And so that, again, kind of makes us wonder, where are we going to fall and how is this going to be? But there's certainly a divide around that. Now, these are the things, though, that I think are really beginning to hit us in Congress in some different ways. So this is a question. Percent who say college and universities have a positive or negative effect on the way things are going in the country. So red is positive. So among Republicans, in 2010, it was 58% said, yeah, higher education is having a positive impact. In 2017, it was 36%. Right? I mean, it used to be completely opposite. It has flipped completely in the political parties over the last 10 years or so. And you can see, These are Republicans. All of these are Republicans, and all of these are Democrats. Okay? So in the Republican Party, those that used to be positive have gone down, and those that used to not be positive have gone up. Okay? Democrats have stayed about the same. Okay. Now, percent who say college and universities have a positive effect. You have to drill down on this question, though, still. And if you begin to look at it, when you look at the who has positive, okay, this is Democrats, this is Republicans, only 27% of Republicans that are 65 and older believe that it has a positive effect. But if they are 18 to 29, still you have 52%. So there's very different, like the older you are as a Republican, the less you believe in higher education. And it has shifted so dramatically, it's hard to know. If you're a college graduate, you're more negative. And if you make $75,000 or more, you are more negative. So if you're older, if you make more money, and if you have a college graduate, a college degree, that's kind of where your place is. And then you see it just a little bit different in the Democratic side of the House. Now, so we kind of say, so what? Well, I think for us in faith-based universities, we know the so what, because we belong to denominations, and the denominations are trying to figure this out, and the denominations are struggling with how do they stay together and how do they work together. But what has happened on the university campuses is SERP is the survey that we give out to incoming freshmen. And so I think it's 3,000 universities across the country give out SERP every year. It measures attitudes in our incoming freshman class and how they're changing and shifting. In 2016, it was the most politically polarized in the 50-year history of the tool. So it's not just something that happens out here. It is happening on our campuses every single day. I have a faculty friend, and we were talking about he teaches in a course where there are some topics that are pretty controversial. And he said they used to be the most enjoyable days that he had because it was good dialogue and a lot of good going back and forth. And he said now the vitriol in the room, the emotion in the room, the unwillingness to listen to the other side of the argument, he said, I am really backing off doing those kind of things because they just erupt, and then they hurt my teaching evaluations and all sorts of kind of things. And I said, oh my gosh, please, whatever you do, do not stop doing that. This is where we should be teaching civil dialogue, right? If we don't do it at liberal arts, where will they do it in America? If we don't teach them the attitudes of being able to not agree with someone but to still listen to them, but you can see all across institutions, I hear faculty all the time talking about the pressure that they're getting, and the minute that they come off, if they even allude to or even appear like they're on one side or the other too strong, you know, it comes back to haunt them. And so there's a real kind of fear that begins to grow up. But we do know that we've had more incidences of hate speech on college campuses in 2018 than ever in our history. Okay? So we do know it is heating up right where we are. Okay? This divide is creating a very different educational environment than we've ever had before. All right, and my very last one is the pace of... I should ask, anyone have any questions on that? I'll give you a chance to talk in a minute. Because I'm doing exactly what good faculty would say don't do, and that is just talk to you at 2:30 in the afternoon, okay? So we'll get a chance here. But the pace of learning in society is another one of those. things that are shifting underneath us, and we don't even know exactly what to do. You know, we moved from this agricultural to industrial, and it was really, and agricultural is really a small classroom, the farmhouse. Industrial is where we began to have large research one institutions where we would educate hundreds of people in the classes. And then we began to really move to kind of more of a knowledge society where we began to, it wasn't just about everybody knowing how to work in the factory. It was really about understanding the knowledge, those kind of things. Well, now we're really in a whole new time in America, and that is what we call the learning society. What we will find is that a high percentage of the jobs, some say 47, some say as high as 72, well, those jobs will be automated in the next 5 to 10 years. In fact, the technology already exists to automate those jobs. It's just getting the capital outlay and doing it, all right? So what economists would say, though, is that's not troubling, because that's happened in our history before over and over again. He said, but what the economists say is that what will have to be is new jobs will have to be created with new knowledge and new industries and all those kind of things. So one of the jobs that is most vulnerable, or is kind of vulnerable, I was giving this to a board of regents one time, and I told them, these are the jobs that are most vulnerable, and the guy in the front row was one of them. I said, accountant, right? I said, accounting. And we already send a tremendous amount of our accounting to India, but it is getting more and more automated so that the ability of artificial intelligence and machine learning to do our taxes and to automate them, so accountants begin to be that. But the thing about it is that I always remind people is that, yes, just the rote accounting can be automated, but to understand our tax code, I mean, it takes almost a PhD, doesn't it? Like, I mean, I have a PhD and I can't do it. So it is the higher order of thinking, the problem solving, the creativity that is going to be the most important part of what we do. But our education systems are still set up to do the industrial age, right? They're still set up to, like, we are training students to do something that's rote, or, you know, in our education system. But you do see, because of this new emphasis on learning, you do see all sorts of different expressions in higher education now. We've known MOOCs. Everybody said MOOCs is really going to transform higher ed, and it hasn't, but I think it still has its place. But you begin to see this education system that is a lot less tied to the university, right? And a lot more free, fast, agile, can change, can work closely with organizations and those types of things. And I think this is something that we've got to begin to understand. You know, we move really slowly in a very kind of, I would say, sophisticated way, but very arduous way, right? But that doesn't fit with the learning society. So it'll be interesting to see how we move forward. Okay, now, I cannot, we'll see if this video runs all the way through. It is yet to do it, so. Oh, you know what? I'm going to actually go down. Play it off of my computer. Nope, that didn't do it either. No, let me just go back. So we'll try it. It may only get halfway through, but it'll give you a sense of it. This is a video that Cisco put together, which I always think is interesting when business and industry makes a statement on education. Yeah, okay. All right, that was good. Okay, so I'm just going to try to, I'm going to have to shut the whole thing down and bring it back up again. But this is good, because this is where we need it. We're going to take a break anyway. So what I'd like for us to do for just a few moments around our table is, now that we've been through all this, no one has run out of the room, which I appreciate greatly. But as you put all this together, as Board of Regents, what should we be doing about this? What should we be thinking about? Of all the things I covered, what are the things that most concern you for your particular institution? Okay? So let's spend about 15 minutes just having a conversation about, so what? All right? So we've kind of known that, maybe not specifically enough, but now what do we do? Where do we go, and how do we help as a Board of Regents? So what was the nature of the discussion in your groups? Anybody want to be brave enough?
And we have talked at our table about the difference between traditional forms of delivering education versus the adult education forms versus now online. And prior to that time, it was always just differences in delivering the same educational services. And now, with one of those slides we were putting up, now we're having to begin to think about differences in the types, not just the platform. Methods of the educational services that we're delivering, but just the types of services that we're delivering. We're tempted to stay in our little boxes of the BA and the PhD and that sort of thing. And one of the things we need to start thinking about is thinking about outside the boxes so that we will have offerings that help the skill sets that we need for the next generation of workers. Some excellent comments were made about thinking outside the boxes in terms of our geography. Now that most of us, if not all of us, are online, why are we marketing ourselves only in the States? Are there any prohibitions, are there any restrictions that would keep us from marketing ourselves overseas? What about marketing ourselves and offering instruction in multiple languages with the huge growing Hispanic community and the growth of Protestantism in Latin America? People may want Christian higher education down there. Korea, the growth of Christianity in the last 50 years in Korea, that's another market.
So absolutely.
Geography, language, and the types of educational services that we're delivering. We also talked about the importance of spending dollars on marketing.
It's the truth. I mean, you know, I've been a faculty for 15 years, so I hate to hear it, but my last 2 years working back in administration, like marketing is central. It's central. A different kind of marketing than we've ever done, but it's central. You know, it's interesting on the international front because part of what's really hurting institutions right now is our international students aren't flowing to us. And the problem with flowing the other direction is we just cost so much more than everyone else does. So you go to South America, you go to South Africa, you even go to China, Korea, their cost of education is so much lower than ours is that we have to lower our education cost to the point where it's almost not cost efficient for us. But I wonder, this is what I've wondered for a long time, a university in Florida, Southeastern University, it's a Assemblies of God, right? So they took their little 400-person online institute group, and now it's 5,000 in 4 years. How they've done it is they partnered with the local churches, right? So like you're saying, expand. They've expanded out to local churches all over the country, and the local church houses and recruits for them and builds their course. They do some small profit sharing with them, so it helps the church to become more sustainable. But it gets the message out. They're in places where they would never have any kind of brand recognition, but because it's tied to a church. Why can't that work internationally, right? Like, our denominations have international places that we could defer some of the cost of education. Like, if we didn't have to pay for huge marketing, huge recruitment, all those types of things, we could make it more affordable. And I think that's should be part of our mission as faith-based universities, to think in some really different, more global ways of how we access that. But you've kind of hit on the problem, and I'll end with three or four ideas, but it is that challenge, isn't it, when we say think outside the box? Because heretofore, higher education in the U.S. is still the best thing we have going along. Of the 50 top universities in the globe, we have 40 of them, right? So we still, have this great thing. But the 40 are the elites, and all the rest of us are down here trying to become elites. We still have this elite envy. We still think that we should all be doing research, that we should all be teaching the same way they're teaching. And I said, we've got to get out of that. We've got to find who can be, what's the best version of Indiana Wesleyan? What's the best version of Houghton? Not what the best version of Tulane is, what's the best version of Warner Pacific? And I think it's going to have to be a lot more creative. I'm going to end with a few questions and give you some things to think about as we go. So I'm always big about like that's such a great statement that you made. I am big on what if, okay? So what if we conceptualize our institution as beginning for learning across the lifespan? So what we do right now is, for most of us, it's really hard for us to get out of the idea that our institution is a traditional undergrad college experience, right? It's what we experience, it's what we love, it's what we love about the institution. And if that's all it becomes in the next 10 years, you won't be sitting here anymore, okay? It's just not possible. And we've used the adult program to this point to prop up the traditional undergrad, right? So what's happened is we haven't invested like we should into these, and now these entities are dependent upon us for a revenue share, right? Which is declining as well. But what really needs to happen is the revenue from those entities needs to pour back into those entities so that they can do better marketing, be more creative, more innovative, those kind of things. But we're kind of taking the life out of those to try to fund this still. And so this can be little more than mediocre, right? You look at a place like Southern New Hampshire, they're completely separate, right? And so the College for America side can build and grow and those kind of things. They have some cost sharing that comes back to the university, but it's not as onerous as most of us feel and those kind of things. So we have to begin to think about those things, and we really have to begin to think about education across the lifespan. To this point, this has kind of been what we've thought about, right? It's kind of what you were mentioning, Keith. It's kind of how we've conceptualized ourselves, bachelor's, master's, maybe some into the high school. But we've got to really begin to pull out education and not make it just this one age group. But education has to happen across the lifespan now. You know, I have a couple of friends who were stay-at-home moms. Their kids just went out of college. They're like, I wish you had a degree for me, right? Like, now I got to figure out. I got to go through freshman orientation, right? I got to figure out my life now, right? And there are a lot of people, even in their careers, that are beginning to do that. And we're living longer, and we're going to continue to live longer, right? So I could have put out there to 100. I mean, 95, this is also what's killing Social Security. But we're living so much longer that we have to pull out the way we're thinking about education. And we're missing a huge market if this is all we think about in terms of education. And I think that there's a whole new world for us to begin to think differently about it. What if we really took finding other ways to fund higher education seriously, okay? We have five ways right now. Tuition is our big dog, development, financial aid, grants, those types of things. But we really haven't thought any differently than that right now. There are a few campuses that are trying some different things. One of them is work colleges. Have you heard about this model, this idea? So Huntington University is one that's moved out. They started an entity called Huntington HU Ventures, okay? And from that, they actually run a Google distribution area. They run it out of their business school so that the students learn how to run businesses. But all the profit that's made goes back into their foundation that turns around and funds the scholarship for the kids that work in that entity. We're launching one in the fall at Warner for our graphic design and our digital design and marketing department. We took one of our old houses on campus, and we're getting it right now. We're making it into a digital marketing firm, right? So the students come in, and they work. The first year, they work on customer behavior, sales, those kind of things. Second year, product development. Third year, leadership management and finance. So they work through the development of a business. But at the same time, we're going to churches and nonprofits who can't afford the big graphic media, the social media outreaches that the other firms do. And we're just charging a fraction of that. But it gives our students this great opportunity to work and those kind of things. And then the income comes back in. You have to set up a separate foundation. But the income comes back into the foundation. The foundation feeds it. We need business people to get involved and to help us to understand how to create businesses from our university. We don't have to be something. And what a great experience for students to actually work in an entity, and then their third year, they're really about running it, and it's up to them to build the ROI and those types of things. You see some universities beginning to toy with this. Grace did this. We are one of the only higher education systems in the world that have four-year college degrees, 4 to 6 year college degrees, right? If you go to Europe, everybody's a three-year model. The fourth year of our education runs our cost of education up, right? Because it's one more year our students aren't in the earning pool, They're not doing it. And so they're having a good time, huge amount of waste, especially in the summer months. You know, so what we're trying to do is to think in terms of two pathways. You come in because we have a lot of low-income students, and low-income students can't afford. You know, I always said, part of my Baylor education was I worked at a summer camp for two summers, right? Well, you know, quite frankly, it's kind of a privileged position because I made squat at the summer camp, right? There's no way I could have actually funded my education over the summer camp. And so we built our model around this summer off idea. And anytime I talk about this, my faculty colleagues want to kill me. I mean, they really do, because we will take less money because we want the summers off, right? I'll just tell you that right now. Mm-hmm. It's quality of life. But it's a crazy business model. We've got classrooms and things sitting empty. We've got a workforce that's out at Bermuda, playing golf, and we need them. We've got to relook at those assumptions that go in to those kind of things and consider three-year degrees. Networked universities. So there's kind of been a move and a rumbling about merging institutions. Now, the latest study that they did on merged institutions found that actually they don't save as much money as you would think they do. You actually end up replicating costs. But what they have found is building these relationships in these consortiums, okay? So food services, if you have five institutions and you are going out for bid for a food service, you get better deals if you have 10,000 students as opposed to 5,000 students, right, or 3,000 or 2,000. In our small institutions, we have got to get more networked together, right? We have to buy things in bulk. It's the way to do it. Everything from our furniture to our reusable goods, but also online program development. You know, we all have these, online course developers, and they all develop our degrees. I'm like, why don't we come together and develop these degrees together, and then you can spin off and make your uniqueness, right? You can spin off from there, but math is math, okay? Marketing is marketing. There's not something too unique about that. So just thinking in terms of how do we get more networked to drive our price down, and it will be a change of idea, because right now we think in terms of competition, not networking. This is a big thing of mine, but we've got to recreate our classrooms to build more engaged learning communities. I mean, we've got to have, you walk into our classrooms, they are exactly the same, white paint, these boring tables, and I always ask my students, what do you feel when you walk into the classroom? And you know what they say to me? Boredom. They say boredom. So we've got to really even rethink the way the classroom is. And we'll see if this video will show for us. Probably won't. But this is a Stanford classroom. Seventy-two. So you begin to get the idea. But it's that kind of flexibility in our classrooms, that kind of movability to really create these learning environments that are more reflective of the work environment that they're going to be coming into. I was laughing. I teach a design thinking class, and it's in our doctoral program, and it goes from 1 o'clock to 5 o'clock. I mean, it couldn't be any worse, okay? They've been in class from 8 to 12. It couldn't be any worse, so I said, I want there to be a couple of hours where we're at standing tables, right, so that we can get the blood moving, we can do our design, those kind of things. You would have thought I had asked for someone to kill their firstborn male child. So I finally went down to Home Depot and got, some concrete things and just put my tables on top of concrete, because I said, we've just got to have more flexibility. We've got to get away from the idea of a lone faculty member, one class, right? Because you're so limited by what one faculty member knows and can do and can learn. We've got to build teams that can redesign it. We've got to have a faculty member that has the expertise and the discipline. We have to have designers. We have to have technology gurus. And we have to bring in outside experts, people who know what the cutting edge of our field is to teach our students. And we need to double down in the classroom and not allow boring classes anymore. Right? We have got to create more engagement, and we only do that by moving away from the lone faculty member model. Now, again, my faculty colleagues. We're not going to like that across the board. But we've got to move and we've got to challenge these things. We've got to reconceptualize living on campus, quite frankly. The residence halls are, you know, we say they're a cost center, but if you really do drill down and we look at all the costs that it keeps to keep them up and those kind of things, we look at them as a revenue generator. They really are a cost center. And we've got to reconceptualize them. You know, it's interesting in student affairs, so I traveled around. I did the study of innovation in universities. So we're about 80 different universities across the country. And we would ask them, where are your most innovative things going on? Now, don't get me wrong. I was the vice president of student life at Baylor. I'm a student life person at heart, right? Not one campus, not one, told us something that was happening in student life. That should not be. Right? That should not be. We need to turn our residence halls into maker labs. You know, we need to do student-run businesses in the halls, so they're right there learning. We need to have community rooftop gardens. We need to have residence hall directors that are thinking about what are we going to learn in this place at this time. All right, and then I think I've done just about enough talking for a lifetime. Here is my email address if you want these cards. But I think at the end of the day, what I hope you take from this is it just isn't going to work to continue to do the same thing and to think that we are going to be able to maneuver the change in America and still be vibrant. We have to start at our core. We have to challenge some assumptions and deep assumptions. And we have to stop saying, well, we can't ask faculty to change. Bullhooey, okay? Everybody in America is changing, okay? Everybody changes. As a faculty member, if I'm not changing, I'm not any good to the students, right? So we've got to step up to the plate, challenge the assumptions. Thank you so much, and reimagine Christian higher ed.